They fell on them like hungry tigers, for well I know that for months tobacco was dreamed of and talked of. Some of the hands were in a rather bad way, but he had held the party together and kept hope alive in their hearts. There was no time to exchange news or congratulations. I did not even go up the beach to see the camp, which Wilde assured me had been much improved. A heavy sea was running, and a change of wind might bring the ice back at any time. I hurried the party aboard with all possible speed, taking also the records of the expedition and essential portions of equipment. Everybody was aboard the Yelcho within an hour, and we steamed north at the little steamer's best speed. The ice was open still, and nothing worse than an expanse of stormy ocean separated us from the South American coast. During the run up to Punta Arenas, I heard Wilde's story, and blessed again the cheerfulness and resource that had served the party so well during 4.5 months of privation. The 22 men on Elephant Island were just at the end of their resources when the Yelcho reached them. Wilde had husbanded the scanty stock of food as far as possible, and had fought off the devils of despondency and despair on that little sandspit where the party had a precarious foothold between the grim ice fields and the treacherous ice-strewn sea. The pack had opened occasionally, but much of the time the way to the north had been barred. The Yelcho had arrived at the right moment. 2 days earlier she could not have reached the island, and a few hours later the pack may have been impenetrable again. Wilde had reckoned that help would come in August, and every morning he had packed his kit in cheerful anticipation that proved infectious, as I have no doubt it was meant to be. One of the party, to whom I had said, "Well, you are all packed up ready," replied, "You see, boss, Wilde never gave up hope, and whenever the sea was at all clear of ice, he rolled up his sleeping bag and said to all hands, 'Roll up your sleeping bags, boys. The boss may come today.' And so it came to pass that we suddenly came out of the fog, and, from a black outlook, in an hour all were in safety homeward bound. The food was eked out with seal and penguin meat, limpets and seaweed. Seals had been scarce, but the supply of penguins had held out fairly well during the first 3 months. The men were down to the last Bovril ration, the only form of hot drink they had, and had scarcely 4 days' food in hand at the time of the rescue. The camp was in constant danger of being buried by the snow, which drifted heavily from the heights behind, and the men moved the accumulations with what implements they could provide. There was danger that the camp would become completely invisible from the sea, so that a rescue party might look for it in vain. It had been arranged that a gun should be fired from the relief ship when she got near the island, said Wilde. Many times when the glaciers were calving and chunks fell off with a report like a gun, we thought that it was the real thing, and after a time we got to distrust these signals. As a matter of fact, we saw the Yelcho before we heard any gun. It was an occasion one will not easily forget. We were just assembling for lunch to the call of "Luncho," and I was serving out the soup, which was particularly good that day, consisting of boiled seal's backbone, limpets and seaweed, when there was another hail from Marston of "Ship-O!" Some of the men thought it was "Luncho" over again, but when there was another yell from Marston, lunch had no further attractions. The ship was about 1.5 miles away and steaming past us. A smoke signal was the agreed sign from the shore, and, catching up somebody's coat that was lying about, I struck a pick into a tin of kerosene kept for the purpose, poured it over the coat and set it alight. It flared instead of smoking, but that didn't matter, for you had already recognized the spot where you had left us, and the Yelcho was turning in. We encountered bad weather on the way back to Punta Arenas, and the little Yelcho labored heavily, but she had light hearts aboard. We entered the Straits of Magellan on September 3rd and reached Rio Seco at 8 a.m. I went ashore, found a telephone, and told the governor and my friends at Punta Arenas that the men were safe. 2 hours later we were at Punta Arenas, where we were given a welcome none of us is likely to forget. The Chilean people were no less enthusiastic than the British residents. The police had been instructed to spread the news that the Yelcho was coming with the rescued men, and lest the message should fail to reach some people, the fire alarm had been rung. The whole populace appeared to be in the streets. It was a great reception, and with the strain of long, anxious months lifted at last, we were in a mood to enjoy it. The next few weeks were crowded ones, but I will not attempt here to record their history in detail. I received congratulations and messages of friendship and good cheer from all over the world, and my heart went out to the good people who had remembered my men and myself in the press of terrible events on the battlefields. The Chilean government placed the Yelcho at my disposal to take the men up to Valparaiso and Santiago. We reached Valparaiso on September 27th. Everything that could swim in the way of a boat was out to meet us. The crews of Chilean warships were lined up, and at least 30,000 thronged the streets. I lectured in Santiago on the following evening for the British Red Cross and a Chilean naval charity. The Chilean flag and the Union Jack were draped together. The band played the Chilean national anthem, God Save the King, and the Marseillaise. And the Chilean Minister for Foreign Affairs spoke from the platform and pinned an order on my coat. I saw the President and thanked him for the help that he had given a British expedition. His government had spent £4,000 on coal alone. In reply, he recalled the part that British sailors had taken in the making of the Chilean Navy. The Chilean Railway Department provided a special train to take us across the Andes, and I proceeded to Montevideo in order to thank personally the President and government of Uruguay for the help they had given generously in the earlier relief voyages. We were entertained royally at various spots en route. We went also to Buenos Aires on a brief call. Then we crossed the Andes again. I had made arrangements by this time for the men and the staff to go to England. All hands were keen to take their places in the Empire's fighting forces. My own immediate task was the relief of the marooned Ross Sea party, for news had come to me of the Aurora's long drift in the Ross Sea and of her return in a damaged condition to New Zealand. Worsley was to come with me. We hurried northwards via Panama, steamship and train companies giving us everywhere the most cordial and generous assistance, and caught at San Francisco a steamer that would get us to New Zealand at the end of November. I had been informed that the New Zealand government was making arrangements for the relief of the Ross Sea party, but my information was incomplete, and I was very anxious to be on the spot myself as quickly as possible.